Back by popular demand, David Wilcock, his latest work, The Ascension Mysteries, revealing the cosmic battle between good and evil. That's what we're talking with David about next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, David Wilcock with us. David, of course, author, lecturer, researcher. He has intensively researched ufology, ancient civilizations, consciousness science. He is a subject and co-author of the international bestseller, The Reincarnation of Edgar Cayce, because he may indeed be the reincarnated Edgar Cayce. And his latest work is called The Ascension Mysteries, revealing the cosmic battle between good and evil. Here he is, and welcome back to Coast, David Wilcock. David, always a pleasure. Welcome back.
Good to hear that you're still using my 12-year-old bio, but better than nothing.
You know what? It continues to just get better and better and better. This book I had in Los Angeles, I knew we were going to do the interview with me in St. Louis, so I shipped it, and the UPS guy called me and said, "Are you sending a suitcase? What is this thing?" That's a big book.
It doubles as an effective weapon when needed.
Indeed, indeed. So what's new with you? I saw you, luckily, in Denver, where we taped another Beyond Belief episode, but you've hit a home run with this one.
I didn't try to throw a glass of water on you this time.
No, you were very nice to me this time. How come?
Things are going really well. It's very much like akin to giving birth when you have a book like this, and this has been an incredible labor. I concocted this thing as a result of people giving me briefings about the history of our solar system. And it's a very strange story that starts with people that had extremely high technology, apparently some 2+ billion years ago. And they used a material called transparent aluminum and built these obelisks and pyramids on moons, not only all over our solar system, but apparently at least 12 or 13 neighboring stars as well. So this was a very, very prolific and widespread civilization, and then they just vanished. And that's what everybody calls the ancient builder race. And when you start talking to people on the inside, everybody knows about this thing. And I'd never really heard about this before 2014. And then I got this authorized disclosure from the United States government from a high-ranking official who'd worked in both the Reagan and the Clinton administrations. And he gave me all this stuff, and he said, "David, we don't want to put this on the news, so we're going to hand it to people like you, and then you get to put it out there first, and then later on we're going to come in and prove that you're right." Well, that part hasn't happened yet, but I did my due diligence, and I took what they told me, and I tried to combine it with as much scientific research as possible. And ultimately what we're doing is we're charting the history of a refugee group that apparently crash-landed on Earth 55,000 years ago and became what most people are now calling the New World Order. These people apparently do trace themselves back to a race of extraterrestrials that came here. Basically, they got marooned. Their ships, they were in a war. They got shot at. Their ships were billowing fire and smoke, and they crashed on Earth, and they didn't have enough techie guys to be able to figure out how to rebuild them to get off the planet again.
And nobody came to save them, I guess.
Nobody came to save them. In fact, people were coming to kill them, so they had to go and hide. And this is all considered common history. So I really feel as far out in sci-fi as all this is, I'm really just trying to be a historian. And there apparently are many ET groups that have been refugees here, some of which interbred, some of which did not. And this is really just tracing the one that has the most intrigue for us now, because they happen to be running the financial system and a lot of Western governments.
Now, David, the intriguing part of this book is the subtitle, as far as I'm concerned, because revealing the cosmic battle between good and evil. Tell me about that battle.
We're starting to get into it right now in terms of what I'm describing with this refugee group that crashed here. There's a very interesting process involved in ascension. And ascension, of course, is not just a Judeo-Christian concept. Ascension is something that appears in Islam. It appears in Buddhism. It appears in Hinduism. It appears in Jainism, it appears in Celtic lore, it appears in Irish mythology, Native American spirituality, you name it. 35 different ancient cultures around the world, as you always hear me saying, because this goes back to something Graham Hancock was writing about back in 95. 35 different ancient cultures all talk about ascension, and they all give a very similar setup that includes this idea of a massive cycle of 25,000 years on Earth, and that it wraps up at the end. Well, what is ascension? Ascension is ultimately the spontaneous evolution of the human being into a higher form. And if you want to get to what that means, you got to look at things like the teachings of Christ. And I'm not a Christian here. I'm not trying to push one religion. I mean, I have very strong sympathy with Christianity in terms of the core message that it teaches, because I think that message is dead on the money. But I also don't want to disregard the value of other contributions from other teachers.
Right.
So I think that when we look at this thing, ultimately, how loving we are, how kind we are, how compassionate, forgiving we are is the key. And we're in kind of a matrix or hologram in which there are adversarial forces, both in terms of what we would think of as spiritual and in terms of what we would think of as extraterrestrial, in which case they're more flesh and blood based, and also people on Earth who help them, i.e. the New World Order cabal folks. And this battle is very real, and the negative has every incentive to try to keep us enslaved, because they actually feed on that. We generate an energy that they use for sustenance. They call it Lush.
Lush?
Yep, and it's based on Lucifer. That's where it comes from.
Oh, boy.
So Lush is what we generate when we have anger, when we have fear, when we have jealousy, possessiveness, competitiveness, stress, pain, depression. All those things that we think of as just stuff that we run into every day, they vitally require it for their survival. And this is where it starts to sound like some cheesy B science fiction movie, and I get that. But I'll tell you what, George, after 20, 30 years of investigation, 20 years of very active being online, you get enough different people that all tell you the same thing, and they can prove that they worked with presidents in their administrations, and they can show you their military paperwork and validation, and they show you pictures of things that they're not supposed to have and documents that they're not supposed to have and so on. And you meet, let's say, 15 or 20 different people like that, and they all start telling you the same stuff. After a while, you got to use Occam's razor, the old philosophical argument that, you know, it's probably true. But the story is just so huge. And this battle between good and evil, it's playing out every day. It's playing out on the headlines. And it explains a lot of things that are so mysterious.
Can you predict what side will win?
Yeah, I think that, first of all, okay, that's actually a more difficult question than it might appear to be.
Sure.
Because everybody gets what they need out of this event. And the event is some kind of energetic release from the sun. And in this book, I don't know if you got through the whole thing, and I'm not going to grill you on the air about that. It's 500 pages long. So
it's huge. And I'll tell you the truth. I didn't get through the whole thing.
Okay. Well, I didn't expect.
I planned to read it on my plane back to L.A.
That's pretty confident. You think you can blow it out on a plane ride?
Really?
Well, look, there's some really interesting stuff where I start to go into new data that I've never revealed before in describing not only some ancient religious prophecies, but then prophecies that iterated into Greek and Roman philosophy. And what do I mean by that? The oldest religion on earth is Zoroastrianism. And you could kind of say that Zoroastrianism and Hinduism both emerged from one single common origin, which appears to be in what's now Siberia. And those people originally were living in a more tropical place before the Earth moved its position, causing a terrible cataclysm that we call the Atlantean flood or the Noah's flood in the Bible. And these people had to migrate south where it was warmer, and one strain became the Hindus and one strain became the Zoroastrians. Well, these people were very well aware that the sun gives off a big flash of energy and light at the end of these great cycles that they talk about. What I didn't realize until I started to do research for this book is that that science continues forward into Greek and Roman philosophy, where it's known as ekpyrosis. And the scholarship on ekpyrosis, up until I wrote this book, and I think a lot of people are going to look at it now, it was so obscure that I was finding scientific papers that only had 23 hits. And yet they're like so relevant to everything that everybody on coast is talking about. Because these are Roman and Greek philosophers who absolutely believe that the sun gives off some big flash of light and energy at the end of the cycle, and that it completely changes what it means to be human. And that is the center of gravity that all this other stuff is orbiting around. It's a very interesting discussion because we like to think of a steady state universe in which everything just kind of keeps ambling along and does its thing, and it's boring, and it's, I can pretty much see where this is going. Actually not. If the sun does this thing that the Zoroastrians told us about, and the Hindus told us about, and Jesus tells us about, and Buddha told us about it, and everybody tells us about it, the ancient teachings. If the sun actually does this, it's, okay, let's go to the Quran, right? The Muslim Bible.
All right. The Quran.
It says that time stops, and that is also reflected in the Egyptian scriptures, including things like the Emerald Tablets and some other scriptures as well. Time stops. Time comes to an end as we know it. It's a dimensional shift. There's some sort of fundamental change in the way that time processes for us. And apparently, once we go through this, we will have lifespans that are much longer. We'll experience time differently, so that, and again, I'm going to use the Bible a lot, but a year becomes like 1,000 years. So in other words, you could live for what we would think of as 80 years of our time, but now it's like 80,000 years.
Or almost somewhat like Methuselah.
Exactly. So then the weird part is that once we go through this change, we also may develop, we may gain access to extraterrestrial technology that's widely in use all around us right now. And these people have made a unified agreement not to show themselves to us at this time. They can only give us little mysteries and occasional sightings, which of course these days, even a very good quality sighting can be disputed on YouTube because of the ubiquitous presence of motion graphics and computer animation. You don't know if anything's real anymore. It would take a very massive sighting over a major urban area that, you know, thousands of people film with their cameras from different angles. That's what it would take to really break the wall down.
Didn't we get that in 97 with the Phoenix Lights, David?
We got it in 97. We got it in Mexico City, 1991. We got it in 1945 with the Battle of Los Angeles. We got it in 19, whatever it was, with the Fatima sightings of Portugal, where 90,000 people see a silver disc. This is around 1914.
They actually thought it was the sun coming down, which I think is a little ludicrous. I think it was a flying disc.
Yeah, and it created rainbow colors all throughout the sky. And after this event was over, it had been soaking wet. Everybody was soaked to the skin, and yet when the craft disappeared, everybody's clothes were completely bone dry. And that is obviously an advanced technology. They called it a miracle. They also saw what appeared to be flowers coming out of the sky, but they were holograms because when they hit the ground, they disappear. Little white flowers.
That's right.
So, look, 90,000 people saw this. The Battle of Los Angeles, over 1,000 eyewitnesses, apparently over 1 million people actually witnessed it to some degree. they took the craft that was seen and they put a little periscope on the top, and that's what you see in the movie version of War of the Worlds. So, but it's just that, you know, 1952, right? You have a whole fleet of ships that fly over Congress. If that had happened now with people's camera phones, it would be all over.
Oh, sure would.
So we're just waiting for the big one. And I think once that happens, well, I don't think. I mean, it's pretty obvious that everything changes. And if you just look at what's happened in the last couple of days, George, and I'm sure you probably talked about this on your show, and I may be redundant here, but I, just like you haven't read my whole book, I haven't listened to your whole show. So there you go.
Well, but you have listened to the whole show.
Well, in the last few days, they're telling us, and they, when I say they now, I mean mainstream media outlets that are taking their hints from things like AP, Associated Press, you know, the wire service, right? The nearest star to Earth, Proxima Centauri, 4 light-years away.
Great story.
Probably has an Earth-like planet around it that may actually have an intelligent human-like civilization living on it already. And at the same time that they're telling us this, they tell us that SETI is now analyzing a wow signal coming off of a nearby star.
Found by the Russians.
Uh-huh. And at the same time that they're telling us this, they're saying, we found some weird physics thing that allows us to get to near light speed with this microwave engine that we can stick on the end of a rocket and then start traveling around the galaxy. And here's this science geek who's published a paper in a mainstream science journal explaining that, yeah, well, the photon is violating the laws of physics that we know, but basically it just kind of becomes invisible and does its own thing. But yeah, it works. It's a propulsion system. Why are they telling us all three of these things at the same time? If you have the benefit to be able to bend the ears of insiders like I do, then what we're hearing is that on Earth there has been a fierce battle between dispossessed elements from the Pentagon that got kicked out by the cabal and ended up forming an alliance outside the governmental structure. And there's a lot of them. And they're doing this with foreign countries. America is very much involved in this. Apparently, as I've been saying, you know, a sizable majority of certain branches of the intelligence services and the military in America is actually working to uphold their oath of enlistment, which says to defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Okay, they're doing that. And you watch, I just watched them again the other night. You watch movies, the Marvel movies, Iron Man 3 and Captain America Winter Soldier. You don't believe there's an alliance? Well, just watch those movies. It's crazy how much they reveal about this column in the military that's working against these globalists. And what they're doing is they're getting ready to tell us. And even the cabal themselves knows that they're out of time. They're going to have to tell us the truth. So these things, this Proxima Centauri thing and the SETI WOW signal, and the microwave engine, all of that stuff is getting ready for what they call a partial disclosure. And what that means is that they are going to show us ships that they already have that can go around the solar system. They're going to introduce us to astronauts who fly in them. It's going to be very public. And they may not do this right away because they want to try to roll this thing out over a period of time. But then we find out that movies like 2001 were real. And they found these crystalline obelisks and objects on various moons, including the Earth's moon.
That's dramatic stuff. David, we're going to take a quick break, but we're going to come back. David Wilcock, our special guest tonight, his latest work is called The Ascension Mysteries. His website, divinecosmos.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. When we come back, we'll continue talking with him about this difference between good and evil. And also, he's got some incredible information of the secret space program. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. David Wilcock with us. His book, The Ascension Mysteries. It's an amazing book, and it is a huge book, but it talks about the battle between good and evil. And David, I want to talk a little bit more about that and then get into the secret space program. And of course, you and Corey Good do programs for the Gaia Television Network that are just riveting as well. You've been doing this for a long time, but you went through some personal struggles yourself, did you not?
Absolutely. The whole first half of the book is a description of that.
And how did you pull yourself up from the bootstraps to get to where you are now?
Well, in the book, I describe how we are all living. I mean, you know, I was born in 1973. I'm 43 years old now. I grew up in the mass nuclear suicide cult portion of American history. They could fry us at any time. It's very likely, you know, and there's not a damn thing you can do about it. So just, you know, we had these nuclear war drills at school, which they called an air raid drill. But this is a lot more than an air raid. And, you know, I don't really know what the heck it's going to do when you hide under your desk and cover your head.
Not going to work.
Mushroom cloud is coming.
I know it. Not going to work.
It's crazy, right? And Then there was this thing on TV called The Day After. And my parents wouldn't let me watch it because, it's so scary. You know? I went down, it was 1983, and I went up and I watched it. I was 10 years old. And I saw the scenes, and I'm like, I don't need to watch this. It was just scenes of mass destruction. The world had been nuked. And what people don't realize is that the people that put this kind of stuff out, they're aware that our thoughts are a lot more powerful than we realize. And so the cabal folks are trying to use the power of our consciousness against us. They're leveraging that against us. That's what's so shocking about this. They're not coming at it from a perspective of ignorance. They're coming at it from a perspective of great wisdom, and they use our ignorance for profit. So I have a personal story in that, because you read my life account as it's described in this book, and I do basically take it from birth straight up through until I was 19, when I started to break into the UFO stuff and get insiders. And I started out as a very advanced child, child prodigy.
Were you good in school?
Oh, yeah. I mean, everybody hated me. Everybody hated me.
That's why I walked out on paying for your lunch.
And I still haven't been paid back.
No, you haven't.
After all but this time.
Really, kids did not like you in school?
Oh, my God, no. I was bringing a book to school that was how to develop your ESP ever since I was 7 years old.
Oh, my gosh.
I put a white piece of paper over it and wrote free reading on it. And if you take the book, you can still see the indentation where it says free reading if you hold it under a light. And the other thing I kept bringing to school was a monthly magazine called Odyssey, where they took like NASA stories and photographs about various astronomy issues and wrote them for kids.
Did teachers think that you were a little weird?
Well, yeah. In second grade, I did a classroom demonstration of my ESP for the whole class. How many kids have done that?
That's right. And I assume it worked.
Yeah. I had a psychic club. I talk about this in the book, where the kids, I had a group of like, I forget how many exactly. I think there was four kids, maybe five. And I'm not going to say their names, but I definitely remember who they are. And one of them was my buddy, who I was hanging out with all the time. And we'd already been doing this stuff on our own. And they would go around the corner of the building, and they'd pick a number 1 through 10. And they'd all agree that that was the number. And then they'd come back around. And I would just take the first number in my head, and I'd tell them the number, and it was right. And I had 100% accuracy.
Amazing.
And they tried to fool me by coming up with a fake number and then saying, you know, we'll pick the real number now, and then next time we'll pick a fake number, because they thought maybe somehow I could hear them talking, even though they were far, far away, and there's no way that sound could have traveled like that. So they gave me... They come up, and I pick the number, and they're like, yeah, you're right. And they walk away dejected. And then I see one of the kids who ended up being a friend of mine later. He had blonde hair, and he leans into the others, and he starts whispering. And I knew something fishy was going on. And then all of a sudden, I get this big flash of it was the number 7, I believe, and it was all in stage lights like you see at a rock concert. And it just goes, and I see this in my head, and I say, okay, you guys, come on back. You already picked the next number, and it's 7. And they were so shocked that instead of being excited about this or doing anything with it, they never wanted to have a psychic club meeting again. The club basically disbanded.
Jeez. You were too good.
It scared them.
Yeah.
They didn't expect it.
They didn't know how to handle it.
And then my closest buddy, Eric, and I use his name in the book, you know, his parents were fundamentalist Christian, and they quickly ended up not wanting him to do anything with me either. We continued to stay friends, but we didn't do our psychic stuff anymore.
Did they think you were like a devil worshiper or something?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But what I had done is I'd seen this HBO documentary on Nostradamus and said, well, heck, you know, if this guy could do it, you know, he's a human being, then ostensibly other human beings could do this as well. And if I can do it, then maybe if I keep practicing, I'll get to the point where I could be like Nostradamus. And maybe I'll be able to help stop a war. And, you know, these tools might be useful. So why would I want to hog this? I want to teach other people how to be psychic so that we have a better chance of avoiding a nuclear war. And that was my plan. But none of the kids wanted to learn. They were too scared of it.
Because some people believe that you are the reincarnated Edgar Cayce, the great American prophet, at what point in your life did you start thinking maybe you were?
That didn't occur until 1997, and it was in the summer, where I had been working with a hypnotherapist named Skip Weatherford, and he put me under hypnosis, and I was doing readings at the time. I'd been doing them for a year, and the readings started to pull the questions that he was going to ask me out of his head before he could speak them. And for him, that was the TKO. All resistance to the idea of what was going on being fake. All resistance to the idea of what was going on being real was gone, because this can't be done. Somebody can't just read your mind and answer your question without you having to say it out loud. And after that, he says, you got to come over to my house right now. And I go over there eventually, you know, because I resisted at first. And then he throws this magazine cover down, and it's got a piece of white paper over the top, and there's a square cut out of the middle, and there's a face in the square, and it's an old photo from the early 20th century of a guy with a really tall, like 2.5 inch tall, starched collar. And other than that obviously antiquated detail, it's my face, exactly. And he says, "No, who's that?" And
that
I knew he was a
resemblance.
Member of the ARE, the Cayce Group, and uh-huh. They have a magazine called Venture Inward, and I knew that he was a subscriber to that magazine. I said, well, I'm thinking it through, saying, well, that's got to be Venture Inward, and that's got to be a picture of Edgar Cayce. And I say, well, that's Edgar Cayce. And he says, yeah, but who else does it look like? Then I went to Virginia Beach in October of 1997, and all of the high-level Cayce people working for their organization, including the director of their magazine, the art director of the magazine, people of that level, all were recognizing me as Cayce reincarnated.
Had they met you before?
No. I moved there because I believed that the Cayce readings may have been right about the prophecy that California was going to sink into the ocean in 1998.
Yeah.
And, you know, Gordon Michael Scallion was on Coast to Coast a lot back then. And
that's right.
He seemed pretty convincing at the time. He turned out to be very wrong. But he was convinced everything was going in 1998. And I said, well, you know, if Cayce said that Virginia Beach is a safety land, then that's where I want to be.
Uh-huh.
Get there before 98. But then later on, I found out that Cayce had been influenced by a negative entity called Hallaliel, and that those readings that talk about California sinking were from the negative entity. Most of the people that wrote books about Cayce didn't realize that his own group later repudiated those prophecies and said they're not true.
Well, are they not true because of the date, or are they not true because of the event itself?
Well, it does appear that we may have some type of earth change scenario, but the time was certainly wrong.
Right, big time.
And what you experience as this goes on really has to do with what timeline you're on. And if you're on a positive timeline, then you won't experience any catastrophes. It's like a break in the flow of time in which what you experience is essentially what you've invited. And apparently only the most evil folks are actually going to see some kind of catastrophic event take place. And we may not even, if we're on the other timeline, we may not even realize that that timeline occurred. That's how strange this thing is.
Well, it's uncanny, the resemblance, ever since we interviewed you and Winfrey about this.
Well, I want to point out, just so people don't get the wrong idea, the book doesn't even go into that. That's later in the story. This book kind of...
This book you're talking about, yeah. Right.
The Reincarnation of Edgar Cayce book's already been written. My next book that I write all by myself will probably get into all that stuff in a lot more depth.
Okay. Now, let's talk about the Secret Space Program.
Sure.
You have looked at this for some time with Corey Good. You've got a program on the Gaia Television Network that has startled a lot of people. What do we know about this Secret Space Program, David?
Well, let's go back through time for a little bit, and let's talk about the idea that Atlantis is not the only civilization that rose to prominence on Earth. There's been many, many, many of them. And they rise and they fall.
They rise and they fall. And some before Atlantis.
Oh, many before Atlantis.
Yeah.
And that's actually what the Egyptian priesthood told Solon, who then told Plato, which Plato leaked when he wrote Timaeus and Critias and got in so much trouble for. That's where the term Atlantis came into the common lexicon. So they said, the priests of Egypt said, that there had been many other civilizations. And in those civilizations, it's very common that a breakaway group forms in which a higher level of technology is developed than what the people have, and those people form a closed elite. They go out into space. Pretty soon they discover the ancient builder race stuff. They discover all these really cool obelisks and pyramids made out of crystalline material on moons and planets that are all throughout our solar system. Most of the moons in our solar system have these things.
Mm-hmm.
And they break away, and then if there's some kind of catastrophic event on Earth, they're not there for it, and they're off on somewhere other place where they're safe. So you have to understand that this idea of a secret space program is way more complex than most people's imagination can tolerate without some coaching, because we are surrounded by dozens and dozens and dozens of different extraterrestrial civilizations that not only visit us, but this is their home. And that's a very important point. There is such a need for space, for living space on the moon, that the backside of the moon is just developed out as much as you can handle. There's no space left that hasn't been settled. And apparently, according to some insiders we have coming out of the Russian side of things, it's so busy on the night side of the moon right now that it looks like Manhattan at night. It's just totally loaded with light because there's so many different groups there. And there's also a very interesting phenomenon about the Earth, in which it has a honeycomb-like structure where there are literally millions of giant cavities as you go down below the surface, and it can be miles below the surface. But once you get into these cavities, this interesting little rule of biological life and nature is that these cavities have these weird white mushrooms and little white crustaceans and things like that that can live in there. And they have a bioluminescent bacteria on the roof that actually provides light. And so, sure enough, you can go in there, even in its natural state, and you can start with that, and you can develop it. And with a little technology, you can bring in trees and animals and plants and all the stuff we have on the surface and actually live in there.
That's pretty dramatic.
And there are a lot of different civilizations that are actually living inside the planets in our solar system. And they do that because the surface isn't necessarily the safest place to be for very long.
No, no.
And if you process time differently, if a 1,000 years is like 1 year, then a 25,000-year cycle where the sun gives off a big flash of energy, that might only be 25 years for you. You don't want to be sitting around on the surface waiting for that thing.
David, the late remote viewer, Ingo Swann, in his works, always talked about structures on the far side of the moon, to the point where, you know, he was totally convinced that something was there. So it's got to have some credence here.
What I've done with this book is I'm not trying to say take my word for it. As much as possible, I am bringing in the evidence. I'm bringing in photographic proof, such as what's called the Blair Cuspids, a group of obelisks that were photographed on the moon. You can see the shadows coming off of them. They're clearly obelisks. And there's these rectangular pits in the ground around where they are. And those rectangles would represent rectangular rooms under the surface that the meteors hitting the moon and causing craters have smashed in the roof because they're so old that they're kind of falling apart. So I have physical evidence as well as bringing in as many different whistleblowers who have talked about this as I possibly can, quoting from them, correlating what they say, putting it all together. It was a massive amount of effort that went into this thing. And they're all saying the same stuff. They're all telling us that there's very, very ancient ruins in our solar system and in neighboring solar systems. Somebody built this stuff a long time ago. Many other groups have come in since then. And this technology that's the really old stuff is actually better than theirs.
Why hide it from us?
Power and control. It's that simple. When you are trying to establish yourself as a dominant force, you don't want there to be a bigger alpha male on the block. You want to be the bully. You want to be the guy that everybody pays tribute to, tribute payments as well, pay you for protection. So to a large degree, running an effective government is being an effective alpha that everybody wants to finance so that he'll protect you. But if you can say, hey, you know what? There's aliens, and we don't have anything we can do against them, and they're just going to come and go as they choose and pluck people off the planet.
And that's what's happening.
Guys, we got nothing. We got nothing.
We can't stop them.
That's not going to work out too good, you know? Apparently, recently, the military-industrial complex actually has developed ships that can take down these Draco reptilians, which I'm sure David Icke is going to be talking about tomorrow night.
Yeah, yep.
And, you know, they actually are now at parity with them. They have a comparable level of technology to actually shoot them down out of the sky. And that's part of what's happening right now. It's a very exciting time.
Is that smart to do that, David? Shooting them down?
It wouldn't have been before. It wouldn't have been before. But we're in a very different era now because we are being assisted so that we can go through this change with a minimum of discomfort and without the classic alien invasion scenario or the so-called New World Order takeover where we all get to go camping. And I'm not talking about out in the cabin in the woods.
We're going to come back in a moment with David Wilcock. We're going to take phone calls, but also get into the title of his new book, The Ascension Mysteries, and talk more about that and explaining the abilities that we will have as an ascended race. What does that all mean? David's next with us with your calls on Coast to Coast AM.